Wait a minute. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Yoga Teacher Success Interviews. I'm Laura Cornell of DivineFeminineYoga.com, and today I'm really happy to be here with Danielle Brand Lamond, who is a yoga teacher in Washington, D.C., and Danielle teaches a combination of workplace yoga. She actually currently has 3 workplace yoga classes and 2 studio classes and a private, and she is very fulfilled and joyful and grateful. I just had a nice conversation getting ready with her before we started this interview, and a really wonderful thing to know about Danielle is that she has really created the life that she wants, primarily from her basic teacher training, the 200-hour, which she did in 2005. And she has had additional training, but for me, it's just really wonderful to know that we can create as much work teaching yoga as we want to with whatever level of training we have. So we're going to talk about how she did that. And also, she just told me she has a 3-year-old son, so she's really able to integrate her yoga teaching with the amount of work that she really wants to do, so she has time to be with her son and enjoy that mothering process. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Thank you for coming on and sharing your experience with other yoga teachers. Why don't we start with letting you talk about what your work life is like, your yoga teaching is like, and kind of what the different pieces are and what you like about it and maybe what's challenging about it.
Sure. Just a quick correction. I actually have 6 workplace classes and 2 studios and 1 private at the moment. What I love about it right now is that I have a regular fixed schedule that changes little from week to week, and I teach exactly the number of classes that I want to. I teach mostly during the day because a lot of my classes are at work, and so that's business hours, and it's the same hours as my partner, for instance, and so I'm able to be home in the evenings mostly with my son. I do teach on Saturdays as well, which I think many yoga teachers find is something that they end up doing, teaching on off hours. I used to teach a lot of off hours, a lot of evenings and a lot of weekends, and now it's less, less like that. So I appreciate that. My niche really has come to be workplace classes, and I really like that. I like the fact that I can bring the warmth of yoga, the self-care aspect of yoga, the, you know, mind, body, spirit, heart integration of yoga to these places that where people may not necessarily feel much of that in their day-to-day work lives. And I feel like I'm contributing to the greater whole because, you know, Washington, D.C. is a place where a lot of things happen. There are a lot of government offices. There are a lot of lobbyists and lawyers and people who, you know, who may do things that affect everyone in this country. And, you know, if I can bring just a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of warmth into those areas, I feel good.
I love that you see yourself as part of their work, as part of bringing more mindfulness to the work that's going on in Washington, D.C. That's great.
I do. I mean, a very small part, but, you know, everything counts. I love my students. Most of them are regulars, and they've been with me for 3, 4, 5 years. And they really appreciate yoga in their workplace because they need it, and they're really busy, and most of them are pretty stressed out, and it's their, you know, their respite time, their time for themselves. And so, you know, I find that people are really appreciative, and I really like that. Like you mentioned, I have a 2-year-old, and I'm able to keep serving others, keep my skills fresh in the yoga world, and also earn income, but at the same time, you know, be a mom and get to spend a lot of time with my son. These are all things that I really love about the work that I do right now. What's difficult is that as an independent contractor or an owner of your own, you know, small business like I am, there's always a degree of uncertainty about your, you know, work, either in the present or the future. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
You know, things change, people move, sometimes budgets run out, new management comes to studios, gyms, et cetera. And so I think that, you know, to thrive the way that I'm doing it, at least, you need to be okay with a little bit of uncertainty.
Right.
You know, and it's a good way to, it's a good way to help cultivate the trust in the universe, you know, faith that if you're doing what you're meant to be doing, that things will work.
That's right. It's really different from, you know, I used to, for example, be an elementary school teacher, and I would go out and have, you know, you have a paycheck, and you know mm-hmm. that it's going to be the same for those next 10 months or 12 months. And what mm-hmm. I like to think about is it's kind of like there's the ups and the downs when you're self-employed. It really feels wonderful and fulfilling, and it's not as predictable.
Right. Yeah, it's not. You know, as far as practical things like health insurance, I think it would be a lot more difficult if I didn't have a partner with a quote-unquote regular job, you know, who is able to supply health insurance. You know, it would be a lot harder otherwise. But, you know, I know people who do it. It's not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the other thing that's challenging about especially teaching in workplaces and especially a really high-powered, high-stressed place like Washington is that the environments I teach in are not always optimal for yoga. And I have to just, you know, be okay with that and make the space as sacred as I can. You know, I really think that yoga is the attitude that you bring and the intention that you bring and the way that you conduct a class. It doesn't have to be, you know, in a beautiful studio space, although that's great. You know, any space can be a yoga space. So, you know, I've taught plenty of classes with a treadmill going right next to us. and, you know, I've taught plenty of classes where there's noise, and it's a good opportunity, too, for students to remember their mindfulness in the midst of the marketplace, so to speak, you know, in the midst of day-to-day life.
Or maybe really near where their desk is or their telephone is or something, just down the hall from their office, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So maybe give us a picture, Danielle, of the, if you're in six workplaces, maybe give us a picture of the different companies or the different organizations that you go into. Where specifically have you found that these workplaces are wanting yoga?
You know, it's funny that I have tended to work in a lot of healthcare policy sort of organizations.
Okay.
And I think the people who work there are more health conscious, so that's, you know, that's
okay.
The plus. And also, so much of my work has come from word of mouth, and, you know, I've been, for instance, you know, teaching one class in a workplace for a year or, you know, 6 months or whatever period of time, and then somebody who's in that class leaves, gets a new job, goes to, you know, somewhere else, and they say, hey, you know, we want yoga there. Can you come teach for us? So, you know, I end up kind of following different people around, and it's just the field that I've gotten into, the healthcare policy field. So I teach for a government agency that works with healthcare policy. I teach for a hospital or two different hospital organizations. I used to teach at a think tank that had a healthcare policy wing. So that's been my little
your
niche.
Specialty.
Yes.
Well, you're doing alternative healthcare. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. But it's not the only, you know, those are not the only places that are interested. Law firms, I think, are a great opportunity because, you know, lawyers work long hours. They sit at their desk quite a lot of time.
Yeah.
And you know, and they need yoga. They need heart opening. They need, you know, neck stretches. They need hip opening, all these things. And really any workplace that has the capacity or has the space will have people who work there who would enjoy it and benefit from it, I think.
And are you in, like, the boardroom? Are you in an exercise room? Do you have to move chairs when you get there? Do they help you move the chairs?
Well, let's see. There are a couple of spaces that have a dedicated exercise room, so it's not just for yoga, but, you know, usually it's just an empty room. There might be weights that are on the side or something. And either they bring their own yoga mats or sometimes the organization provides them. And I have taught in plenty of conference rooms as well. It depends on the organization. Sometimes they have staff that are dedicated to, you know, facilities management, and they you know, break down the tables and chairs and set it up for yoga and then put it all back afterwards. That was the case in a law firm you know, they definitely have more money at a law firm. When I was at a think tank, that's a lot more, you know, low budget, let's say. We all did it ourselves. You know, I asked people to come a little early, and we all pitched in and cleared things out. In one place right now, I give a student a discount for the class if he, you know, breaks everything down prior. So it really just depends on the space and who's there.
So I hear that you're flexible and you just kind of work with what's going on, and that's kind of one of the ingredients of being successful in a workplace is flowing with their needs and their availability of resources.
It is. It definitely is. But it's a balance also, I think, between, you know, keeping something sacred, deciding, you know, that there are certain parameters and, you know, boundaries and limits that are appropriate for yoga, and then other things that you can give on, because, I mean, that's how life is anyway, right? You can't have everything all at once, usually, but you want to, you know, you want to advocate for things that are important.
So what are some of the things you would say no to, or that would be perhaps an unacceptable environment, or that you would advocate for something different? Do you have an example?
Well, I mean, definitely cell phones in class. Which seems obvious. It seems totally obvious to yoga teachers, but it's not obvious to people who work in Washington, D.C. So I've had to, you know, definitely be firm on that sometimes.
Okay.
And I, you know, I'd like to have a at least semi-private, but ideally, you know, private space, at least for that hour where, you know, either we put up signs that say yoga in progress, or, you know, please, you know, just, you know, whatever signage is appropriate to let people know the yoga going on. And then even though you do that, sometimes there will be noise. Sometimes somebody will walk through the room. But for the most part, trying to preserve that sacred space, everybody feels safe within it, I think it's important. There is a place that I teach where there's a yoga room, but it doesn't have a door. It has like three walls, basically. And you can actually see into the rest of the exercise room with the treadmills and the TVs. And I've been teaching there before, and somebody goes to the treadmill and turns on the TV. And, you know, that was definitely something that I wanted to address. So, you know, that's important. You don't want TV noise while you're teaching yoga.
Right. No, I love that. I love it that on the one hand you're flexible, and on the other hand you kind of set your boundaries and say, okay, we don't want the sound of a television. We don't want cell phones. That you set, and that we don't want people walking through as much as possible. Not that someone might never walk through, because that might be unavoidable, but that you, you know, set it up so that won't happen if possible. That's great.
Yeah.
So I know you're pretty well established. You've been teaching now for 7 years, and you have the classes that you want to have, but maybe we could look at what it was like for you when you were new and you were just coming out of teacher training and you maybe didn't have any classes. How did you get started?
Right.
How did you get going? How did you, you know, step by step grow to this place where you are now?
Well, I was either lucky or blessed or both. I mean, I think both. By the fact that I had a little bit of a built-in network, I moved to Washington, D.C. My husband and I moved to Washington, D.C. to go to grad school at American University. And when I was there, I started basically a yoga club because I wanted to practice yoga. And I, being a grad student, I didn't have any money to go to studios. And
I love that, a yoga club.
And we actually called it a yoga collective. And my view was that we would just kind of take turns leading it, not teaching it, because none, you know, nobody had a certification, and I didn't presume to teach it myself. But you know, that we would take turns kind of guiding other people through some postures. And it turns out that everybody who came wanted to be led. So I ended up leading it. And I had had, you know, probably 10 years of experience, you know, pretty intensively as a yoga student myself up to that point. But I didn't have training as a teacher. And, you know, I never said that, you know, I was able to teach anybody at that point. But, you know, I ended up leading. And so then when I graduated from grad school and I did go to get my yoga teacher training, and then I came back to D.C., I had people who had sort of practiced with me before and who were willing to, you know, pay $10 to come to my friend's apartment and once a week take a class.
Okay.
So I got started that way, and I actually got one of my first formal jobs through American University as well, teaching in their gym, just teaching, you know, to faculty, students, staff, everybody.
So how did you get that?
So Danielle,
how did you get that? What were the steps you took
to get that, that one at
American
class?
University?
Well, so one of the members of the Yoga Collective when I was a grad student was somebody who worked, a staff member at AU, American University, and he put in a good word for me. So it was word of mouth. It was basically, you know, cultivating relationships prior to going into teaching, and then, you know, and then word of mouth has been invaluable for me.
I think that's great because it's true that whatever networks we already have, if we can really just activate them and let people know we're available, we're trained, and we're ready, it goes a long way.
Okay, yeah, great. It really does. And then, you know, so many of my classes have flowed from just, you know, someone took my class once or someone was in a workplace class of mine once, and then, you know, they are interested in me coming to teach at their new workplace or their new gym or you know, whatever. So, yeah, networks are huge.
So the way it usually works, let me make sure I understand this, is that somebody who has taken a class with you before, either in one of your paid classes or maybe when you were a graduate student, they contact you or do you let them know? I mean, did you go back and let everyone know when you finished your teacher training? Did you get in touch with people or they just started calling you?
I did get in touch with them. I definitely did. And,
okay.
And when I was I had to let people know. And when, you know, when I was just starting and just teaching a lot of drop-in classes at various places, and one of them was a synagogue, actually, because my friend's mother was the rabbi at the synagogue, and it was just like right before Shabbat services, you know, self-care yoga on Fridays, but anybody could come. You know, I would just email out to my entire network of people in D.C. saying, you know, please come, do some yoga, support me, you know, that sort of thing. So, yes, I definitely put myself out there.
That's good because I think sometimes for people who are more comfortable putting themselves out there, and I hear that you're really comfortable, which is great, sometimes we can forget that we actually are taking things to let people know. And so activating the network, one of the things is simply just over and over again telling people I'm here, like you said, I'm really enthusiastic to do this. And I'm guessing that you got that job doing the drop-in class at the synagogue through a personal connection.
I did. but, you know, it's not that I was so comfortable putting myself out there. It's just, I mean, I consider myself an introvert, actually, but I just wanted it so much. And I visualized it, I saw it, I affirmed it, and I wanted it. So, you know, so I did it.
That's great. I love that. So you were kind of pushing through an edge where it was a little bit uncomfortable, but you were encouraging yourself that you could do it and just to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are times that it felt really slow, times that it felt like, oh, nobody's responding, nobody's really interested, there's, you know, too much yoga or too much overscheduling. But, you know, it did work out eventually. And it's not necessarily that all those people that I knew personally ended up taking my classes, but, you know, they might know somebody. They might have known somebody who was interested in yoga or, you know, just it's sort of a wider net.
So when you were first emailing your network, was it simply friends, people who, everyone you knew in D.C., people who had been in graduate school with you, or did you have, like, an official business mailing list?
No, it was pretty informal for me at that point. It was just, yeah, people I'd known from grad school. And, you know, I made friends with some professors and staff and, you know, people in the AU general community, and they helped me. And friends and people that I knew from other places as well.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. So when you
And then start... I also, oh, I have to say, sorry, go.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. I also should say that I, in addition to doing all that, I responded to tons of ads on Craigslist and other places for, you know, yoga teachers, and that's how I got a lot of my gym classes, actually, just responding to postings and showing up and you know, meeting them and interviewing like anybody else would. So, you know, I had to do everything to get myself out there. I really had to utilize all different ways.
That's great. I hadn't seen ads on Craigslist for yoga teachers. So you would look on Craigslist or other job bulletin boards?
That's right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I got at least two that I can think of that way, you know, two different gyms that both of those I taught, ended up teaching three or more classes a week at for quite a while. So, yeah, I mean, I would not discount that at all.
Okay, that's a great way to get started. Let's talk about when you would go to a new workplace that maybe you hadn't taught before, maybe somebody who knew you said, hey, I want you to come teach. How would you set it up? How would you do the first class? How would you make the payment arrangements? Would you go through the supervisor, the boss? You know, what were the different practical steps to get a new class started?
So it depends. It does depend on the workplace. In some cases, the HR person would be my contact. Either they would contact me because some employee recommended me, or, you know, occasionally it was because I had contacted them first. So if it's through the HR department, that means usually the organization will be paying for it. And
okay.
In that case, I would just let them know of my rate. And if the organization pays for it, I don't really do sessions. I just do sort of an open, you know, class drop-in, basically.
Okay.
If they want to offer more than one class, I like to offer a beginner and an intermediate.
Okay.
If they just want to do one class, then it's usually all levels so that everybody can feel welcome.
Okay.
If it's an individual, which is often the case, they usually end up, that's the person who's the most motivated to bring the class to their workplace. And so they end up being like the point person, the contact person, the organizer. And I ask them basically to put together, you know, a list of people who are interested and get people to commit. And once they have a commitment from the minimum number of people, then I say, okay, let's schedule the first session. And, you know, of course, I let them know what the payment arrangement is. And I show up on the first day. Usually I did it in 8-week sessions to begin with. And then I switched to 12-week sessions after that because we were just doing a lot of administrative stuff for 3-8 weeks. However, I should add that I have done in several places a free or just one-time drop-in, like $10, for instance, you know, just try it out for the class. Like, you know, anybody and everybody come, see what you think, and if you want to sign up, then we can start the following week, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that you do committed classes, say 8 to 12 weeks, so that you know you have the minimum of students that you need for a class. Is that right? Or so that they're committed? Or
yeah, it's both of those reasons, really. It's because, you know, I found over time teaching that it wasn't working out well for me to just say, you know, every class is a drop-in class, because then, you know, sometimes some weeks you get a good number of people, and some weeks you get, you know, just a few.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, you know, if you're making a living as a yoga teacher, that just isn't very practical. So for, you know, for my income needs, that was important. But also, I think people really do commit more to something that they've already paid for.
Sure.
And
yeah, yeah.
They make it a priority. Yeah.
Right.
And
so
it helps. I'm just going to say it helps build regulars, and with regulars you get to go somewhere in the class. You get to, you know, start somewhere, teach specific, you know, skills, ideas, postures, and then, you know, have them grow with you, and that's really cool.
Right. It's very fulfilling to see people making that progress.
Definitely.
How did you set your minimum number of students, and what is your current minimum number of students, and has it changed, or what is it? Can you say about that?
It has changed. So if the students themselves are paying for it, the way I started was 7 students at $10 per person per class. That's an 8-week minimum. So,
okay.
You know, so I was making $70 a class. And I was charging about that when the organization was paying to. It was maybe 75 when the organization was paying. And just, you know, every couple of years I decided, you know, my income needs are a little bit different and my skills are more honed, that sort of thing, and, you know, so that I would request a raise from the organization or, you know, just inform the people, the organizer of the class that, you know, the new minimum number of people was 8 or 9 or 10. So now it's 10 people minimum if the students are paying for it, because then it's $10 per person per class, and that's $100. So if I get 13 students, then, you know, I make more money, but 100 is the minimum. With organizations paying, it, you know, it really doesn't matter to me how many people come. I mean, of course, I love to have, you know, more people benefit from yoga, but many organizations are willing to pay for even just a few people taking yoga because those people see it as such a boon to their work situation. So
mm-hmm.
That's how I
do
it.
So have you over time, as you've continued to grow, you've been able to let go of certain situations that were not the best for you and really choose the ones that were more meaningful to you? Or how has that worked as you've grown as a teacher?
Definitely, yeah. I think that's a huge part of making it on your own as a yoga teacher is kind of balancing out, you know, your exchange of energy with, you know, making sure it's a good exchange, that you're giving and receiving and that the classes are interesting and fulfilling and you feel good about the environment and everything. So, yeah, there have been plenty of classes that worked for a period of time and then just, you know, weren't resonating with me anymore and I would let go of, and I often try to find another teacher for those classes. It doesn't always work out, but I try. And, you know, I did find over time that gyms were not really where I wanted to teach. It was a great place to get experience and to, you know, actually I found a very loyal clientele at gyms, which was great, but the environment just was not very conducive to yoga to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the pay also at gyms, it depends on the gym, but it can be very low or it can be moderate. Very rarely is it good.
Right. I get it. Yeah, I know that. I agree.
Yeah,
I totally agree. It is a good place to get started.
And then, you know, like just in terms of working with individuals, I mean, for the most part, all of my privates have been, you know, you kind of fall in love with everybody, not in a romantic or sexual way, but, you know, in the way that every person has such a unique, cool thing to, you know, that they are. And so I don't think I've ever felt like, oh, I don't want to work with this person privately anymore. Not that mm-hmm. it couldn't happen. It just hasn't happened to me yet.
Do you want to say something briefly about how you have gotten the private clients? Have they come from your classes or from other ways?
Yeah, they have mostly, I'm trying to think, they mostly come from classes, some workplace, plenty of studio classes. You know, sometimes new students will just approach a studio and they haven't taken a class there before, but they, you know, they want private sessions in order to, you know, kind of get up to speed with yoga or to address a specific condition or injury. So I've taught plenty of privates through and at studios. And then also networking with other yoga teachers. And once you get to know them over time, if they have a private, you know, request that they can't, you know, they can't fulfill, they might contact you, and I've gotten several that way too. And then, you know, I do the same. I refer people to them if I can't do it or, you know, just doesn't work in my schedule or whatever. So I think a network of yoga teachers locally is very important.
So letting your colleagues in your region know that you're available for private lessons and that you might refer to them sometimes, but if they have someone they can't serve, that you're available for private lessons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I ever actually did that, specifically said it, but it just kind of worked out well that way. I mean, I think that you certainly could do that. But, you know, just over time, that sort of rapport grows with the yoga teachers, and you can help each other out, you know, when it's possible. Yeah.
So it sounds like most of the private clients that you have just come to you either through studios where you're teaching or other teachers coming to you, it doesn't sound like you have specifically reached out for private students. Is that right? Or have
that is right, actually. And I anticipated that I would be doing that more, but I guess I was lucky or blessed or both again. And also, I think part of it, and I see this as part of my success in general, on a more sort of energetic or esoteric plane, mm-hmm. Is that I really visualized what I wanted. I really saw very clearly in my mind, you know, the types of classes and you know, the type of schedule and you know, who and where I wanted to teach. And it did come to me.
Wow.
I mean, not that it was easy, not that, you know, it just happened overnight, because it was definitely a process, but a lot of private students just came to me without me having to do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe the steps that you took were not that painful for you.
Well, yeah, that could be it, too. But, you know, but anyway, I'm a big believer in visualizing what you want, seeing it happen, and then, you know, yeah, and then taking the actual steps to make it happen, too, or to help it happen.
Yeah, and I love that idea of visualizing what you want. And I just feel in your energy in this phone conversation how positive you are. And that outlook is really attractive, and I can just imagine that people really want that, that you're, the people that you're serving are really happy to have you there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about that you think would be helpful to other yoga teachers who are wanting to grow and expand or maybe get started with workplace yoga or any other wisdom?
Let's see. I mean, I do believe in being a good guardian and advocate for yourself because you are able to give more as a teacher and as a facilitator of healing, if you take care of yourself for one thing, but also, if you're able to advocate for yourself, and it can be hard to do in a giving field like yoga. But I think that it makes sense to have sort of a trajectory to your path as a yoga teacher. I mean, in the very beginning, when I started teaching, I just taught anywhere and everywhere and accepted, you know, lots of circumstances that I really wouldn't now
mm-hmm.
because I wanted the experience and I was very hungry for it. And I don't regret that at all. It was sometimes exhausting and, you know, I definitely had to, you know, agonize sometimes and soul search a little bit about like, why am I doing this class or why, you know, why am I in this situation? Occasionally that happened. But I just gained so much experience, and then I was able to, you know, be more mindful about what I wanted and where I wanted it. So, you know, if you see things in the long term, I think it's very helpful. Have a path or a trajectory where at first you might, you know, just be teaching, you know, in so many different venues, so many different places, and then, you find your stride and you figure out where you fit in, because not everybody is going to want to do workplace classes. Some people, you know, may thrive in only studio classes or may thrive in doing private only, or, you know, or you
mm-hmm,
know, any combination.
Right.
Yeah.
So finding that path that's going to help you thrive, the where you're going to be the happiest and do your best work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, once you do have the experience, I think that it's, or, you know, not the experience, not like you ever get to a point where you have the experience, but once you have some experience and some, you know, choice over where you get to work, it's okay to be an advocate for yourself and say, you know, no, my teaching is worth this amount of money, whatever you found makes sense in your life, you know, and everybody has different ideas about that. But, you know, to value what you do, to value yourself, I think is very important.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Well, Danielle, thank you so much, and I love ending on this note of valuing yourself because what you do is important. That's a great way to conclude. So I want to tell everyone about your website if they want to just see what you're doing. It's vibrantyoga.com.
Vibrantyoga.com. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. It's a very simple, sweet, beautiful, clear website. So check it out, folks, vibrantyoga.com, and there's a beautiful picture of Danielle there. And when I navigate to another tab here on my browser, because I have the recording up for this recording, and it says specializing in workplace yoga on my tab, so you are extremely clear about your specialization and just lets people know and feel comfortable with what you're doing. I love that.
So
thank you, Danielle. Again, it's Vibrant Yoga. If you want to look at her website, vibrantyoga.com, Danielle Brand Lamond. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your yogic self with all of us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to share any wisdom that I might have gleaned over some time.
I know it was very helpful. I enjoyed listening, and I know those listening to the success interviews will get a lot out of this as well. Thank you so much, Danielle.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Namaste.
Namaste.